This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Is that good? Thanks so much for braving the cold. I feel like everyone needs doubles, right? Everyone needs doubles. I'm going to do something that is radically different from all of the other presentations that I've given on the novel, because I usually talk about the narrative, the story, and I realized that wouldn't make sense at all with the piece that I did for Cabinet, which is, you know, about the history. Oh, I should also say thank you to Sina, who was amazing in the way he asked me for a piece, and I don't know if he told me how long it was meant to be, but I turned in something that was three times as long. And he wanted to keep it, maintain the shape of it. And so he said, well, you know, this has to be one third as long. And I said, well, you do what you want with it. I'm not having anything to do with that. And basically he found a way to whittle it down and make it feel exactly the same. And it was kind of miraculous. As Flies to Wattless Boys tells the story of my mother's family, the Tuckers, and their journey from London to Trinidad in 1845 as part of the Tropical Immigration Society. This was the harebrained scheme of an inventor, visionary, and boldface charlatan by the name of John Adolphus Etzler. He claimed to have invented machines powered by the immense forces of Mother Nature that would transform the tropics into an English garden, basically overnight. My family patriarch and his 15-year-old son, Willie Tucker, also my narrator, were among his first group of pioneers. They went off to a hastily purchased property in the most remote part of Trinidad's north coast, basically a swamp called Chagua Barriga, or Belly of Mud. The pioneers never even got a chance to unpack their satellite, Etzler's wind-powered machine, that would have drained the swamp and planted their first crops. Within weeks, the majority of them, including Willie's father, were stricken by what they called the black vomit. And now they are trapped without a boat to return to civilization. My mother, however, could not tell me this story. She and everyone else I asked had never heard of Etzler or the Tropical Immigration Society, somehow completely removed from the collective memory, which I was able to uncover through my research. The only part of the story my mother knew was its tragic end. Of that 15-year-old boy's bringing his father back out of the jungle on a makeshift stretcher carried by himself, an African, and two Warahoon Indians. They carried him all the way across the mountains of the Northern Range, back to Port of Spain and his family, only to spend his final few hours with them. The culmination of my research was the discovery of a letter fished out of Willie's father's pocket on his deathbed. It contains the only description we have of Chagua Barriga, the place where Etzler's great experiment for humanity came to fruition and met with its tragic end in a matter of weeks. After my years of research, I also realized that I did not want to write a historical book about Etzler. I wanted to tell a small, intimate family story about the Tuckers. Etzler would be relegated to the background, though he'd remain the vehicle of the story, or in his own words, the prime mover. My problem was how to get all of that fascinating history about Etzler out of the way so I could invent the small family story almost from scratch, because I had only a few meager details about the Tuckers. The way I accomplished this was through the prologue, the section of the novel I'll read for you now, which, as it turns out, is a synopsis of my cabinet piece, written in the voice of my narrator, the same young boy, Willie Tucker, though now he's a middle-aged man, remembering back to these events that occurred when he was 15. He's telling the story to his own teenage son, and by this time, Willie is thoroughly West Indianized, so he speaks to his son in a Trinidadian vernacular with a few British inflections. So this is the prologue. I couldn't tell you how this Etzler managed to mongoose everybody. He wasn't nothing to look at. A funny little man with a big beard and piercing eyes and a face consisting of 50% brooding forehead, shaped like a sucked mango seed. A squeaky voice that whistled when he got excited, which was most of the time, and the more excited, the harder he was to decipher with a German accent. But he had the gift. Bold-faced bamboozlement, shameless mongoosiosity. Some would say, amongst others, that he was a genius and prophet and savior and all the rest. But son, I couldn't tell you about none of that bubble neither. It wasn't the Etzler I saw, despite that in his own way he had me mongoose good as everybody else. Mind you, that was 36 years ago. I was only a boy of 15, 3 years younger than you are yourself. First one Etzler mongoosed was another German inventor named Roebling, his friend long since childhood. As young men, these two left on the same ship bound for New York, but that was still a good while before the start of this story. Etzler was on the run because the authorities were taking a lag on his tail over something or the other. They'd jailed him once already, and he was running from his creditors, too. Etzler never went nowhere that he wasn't running from creditors. But he had his friend Roebling bamboozled, as I was telling you, and together they led a group of working-class immigrants on this ship. Yet by the time the ship disembarked, the two leaders had fought. Half the group went with Etzler, other half with Roebling. They went their separate ways, despite remaining friends. Roebling to start a cultivation in Pennsylvania, Etzler to begin an expedition exploring the western frontier, looking for the suitable place to establish his own experimental community. But as it turned out, Roebling would be the one to leave his mark in the history book, not Etzler. Understand, Etzler's public life occupies only a few years, before and after which everything looks hazy, like you're seeing it through a gauze. Roebling, on the other hand, wasted little time deciding he wasn't no kind of weed puller at all. He converted his farm to a factory to mass-produce his newest invention, steel rope. He became obsessed with this thing, and he remained obsessed with it the rest of his life. The same steel rope that eventually enabled him to design and erect the grandest, most magnificent madman monstrosity ever imagined to a present day. The Brooklyn Bridge. Son, I couldn't tell you because I'd never been there. Since I arrived here in Trinidad from London at the age of 15, I've never set foot from it, except to travel to a fistful of other islands. I've never seen this bridge. All I can tell you is that even Roebling kowtowed himself before Etzler's genius. Yet even Roebling couldn't sit in the same room with his childhood friend 5 minutes together without busting out in a row with him neither. Whatever the ass Etzler was doing, leading his band of immigrants stumbling round the American West, like Moses leading the lost Israelites, nobody knows. Presumably, he was evangelizing his machines and ideas. But he couldn't convince those frontier Yankees not for nothing. And before long, he'd lost a handful of German followers, too. They were simple people looking to improve their lives with a few simple creature comforts. They didn't give a pum about changing the world and turning it into an earthly paradise. But Etzler's biggest problem, beginning to end, was his inability to accept contrary opinions, especially when those opinions were coming from people he considered both backwards and bubble-ups. He abandoned the West, turning now to explore the South. But here he bounced up face-first with American slavery, which, of course, his conscience could never condone, and he'd run out of money again. He went to Pittsburgh, maybe back to his friend Roebling, to start the first German newspaper in that town. But Etzler's ego had taken a serious blow, and before long he left America altogether, disappearing again. Now he turned to the Caribbean. He went to Haiti. Possibly during this time he traveled the other islands as far down as Trinidad, most likely. But whatever he did during that time, Etzler managed to recover himself, at least good enough to write out what would become his first publication, printed upon his return to Pittsburgh. And here is where history begins to play she hand. Because that same day that he published Paradise, he traveled to New York for the birthday celebration of a famous Frenchman socialist by the name of Fourier. And it was at this birthday fete that Etzler met the man who'd become his biggest acolyte ever, C.F. Stallmeyer. Yes, it is, son. The same Stallmeyer who built that big, crazy-ass house round the savannah, known to us as Killarney Castle, complete with turrets and towers and Italian stained-glass windows and balustrades of purple hardwood lugged out the jungles of Guyana. Same man they used to call shit-slinging Stallmeyer because he went round the place collecting up cow shit and horse shit and goat shit and any other kind of caca he could get his hands on, only to compress it into fuel and sell for 5 cents a brick. But what he eventually made his fortune from was refining pitch he got gratis out the lake at La Brea, the same pitch lake where Columbus himself went to get tar to cork the hulls of his ships. And Stallmeyer dug it out and refined it and sold it off as kerosene, what we call pitch oil. Because that's the kind of men we're talking about here, son. That's the kind of characters people in this story. Because as it turned out, Stallmeyer never followed Etzler back to America. When he went running from Trinidad with his stones shriveled up between his legs. After the TES had gone to hell and the whole bloody thing was done and dead with, even Stallmeyer had his fill of Etzler by then. Stallmeyer was a fellow German who'd immigrated to Philadelphia a few years before. He was a publisher and he edited a German newspaper too, which only leads you to wonder how he hadn't run into Etzler already. But that was history taking in a deep breath, getting herself ready. Because now at this birthday fete in New York, he not only met him, he read Etzler's Paradise. Stallmeyer became an instant convert. More important, he became Etzler's business partner. Stollmeyer brought him back to Philadelphia, and there the two began to scheme. The place they decided for Etzler to propagate his ideas was England, not America amongst a bunch of backwards country bookies and racist slave owners. England was the place, but that was only the first step. And here Etzler added the twist. He'd get his British followers to immigrate to the Caribbean, to their own West Indies, a place where land was available, free for the asking, closer to the equator, where the powers of Mother Nature were 100 times more potent, only waiting to be harnessed by Etzler's machines. And now it was as if he reached into a hat or a sack of Pomerax and pulled one out. Trinidad, he decided, with its unlimited natural resources and expanses of available fertile land, perfect for cultivation with his own satellite. That's what snagged Stollmeyer, and eventually it would snag the whole of England too. That's the difference between 4 years' airy philosophizing and Etzler's practical plan. Machines. Understand, like all these men we're talking about here, this Stollmeyer fancied himself a scientist and mathematician too. And although he didn't have no formal university training in engineering like Etzler did, he saw the potential for his new friend's machines. Whether or not it was potential to make them a bloody fortune or save the laboring masses from toil and starvation, or both, I go leave up to you to decide. Thing is, here was Etzler with his machines already proven. Not practically, mind you, not in real life, but mathematically. And that's all that mattered. Numbers speak the truth. They could not lie. And let me tell you, Etzler had plenty, plenty numbers propping him up. Within days of arriving in London, they formed a joint stock company called the Tropical Immigration Society. Now not only the British aristocracy and wealthy capitalists could pour their pounds into Etzler's open purse, but the destitute laborers could dump their handful of sticky pennies in as well. At last, Etzler had the two things he'd always needed, two things he'd always dreamed about: a disenchanted populace ready to embrace his ideas for change and immigration, a people anxious to line his pockets too. Everybody and his brother only buying up shares of the TES like Tanya Fritters, one penny at a time, with hopes of immediate immigration to Trinidad. Here, son, in a relatively minor way, is where the Tuckers enter into the picture, but via a circuitous and rather unprecipitated route. Understand, my father, together with his closest friend, a Scotsman ironmonger named Thomas Powell, Pappy and his friend were former members of an underground group based in London known as the Chartists. They'd been radical and militant and until the end, secret, fighting down the crown for all these charters to improve working conditions for the laboring poor in addition to voting rights. But the movement had been crushed by the government, and Powell himself, their spiritual and elected leader, Powell turned informer in the middle of the scrimmage to save the skins of his comrades. The authorities turning round soon as the deal was brokered and busting him and tossing him in jail. Pappy only narrowly escaping Newgate by the skin of his tail himself. So as you can well imagine, this group of just defeated and still hotted up Chartists fell straight into Etzler's hands. All in a sudden, Pappy and his friend began talking about nothing more than the TES and immigration to Trinidad. In their minds, they'd left England already. But son, Pappy would be the fortunate one if you want to call it that. Because whilst he was picked by Etzler to help construct the satellite, Powell was chosen to edit the journal that became the voice of the TES in England, the Morning Star. So time as Etzler was ready to depart for Trinidad with his first group of 37 pioneers, he had no choice but to leave the thoroughly disappointed Powell behind to edit the Star. On the other hand, Pappy and the rest of us, Mum and me and my three sisters, the Tucker clan, you family, we got to go. So that's the prologue, and that's basically the whole of Etzler's history. It's kind of interesting because what I did for Cabinet was rewrite that in reverse. When I wrote that prologue, I just kept whittling it away to see how much I could possibly take out, how much was absolutely necessary, because, you know, it's a big, heavy weight at the beginning of a book, all that history. And then when I went back to do the Cabinet piece much later, I had to go basically use the same piece, change it to standard English, and went back in and filled in all the history. What I'm going to do is read you a very short, another very short section from the novel, comical, hopefully. It's the contemporary voice in the novel, and it belongs to the notorious Miss Ramsall, who is the director of the Trinidad and Tobago National Archives. Miss Ramsall becomes responsible for providing all of the historical documents that enter into the novel. So she's relevant here for that reason, besides the fact that I love to read her, from her voice. Miss Ramsall has charge of the photocopy machine, which she absolutely refuses anyone access to other than herself. Miss Ramsall's voice, as I say, comes to the reader as a series of emails. And these emails are addressed to a Mr. Robot, her pronunciation of Robert. Mr. Robot may or may not bear some resemblance to the author. The emails refer to Mr. Robot's various attempts to connive Miss Ramsall into giving him his photocopies, also his attempts to seduce her, but in the end, it's Miss Ramsall who seduces him. Last thing I should tell you is that the language for these emails is what I call a Trini vernacular cell phone text speak, meaning that it contains lots of numerals and abbreviations and not a single full stop, making it a little difficult to read aloud. It's also a little bit nasty, so forgive me for that. Dear Mr. Robot, you is a effin' shitong, Mr. Robot, is what you is. Because now as I have little chance to catch me breath and cool down some after all them boisterous carryings-ons of last night, of which I can only admit to have played my own part in them too, my womanly desires catching the best of me unawares much as I fight to hold them down, because Krishna only know this Tutti ain't get a good airing out like that in many a long day. And now it finish at last with all that amount of pulsating and throbbing and twitching up so sweet and I could collect up myself little bit and sit down cool and calm and quiet enough this morning to write you out this email and put everything down clear in black and white for you to hear, so listen good what I'm telling you, eh? If you think you could get your hands on this photocopy machine easy as that, You're mad like effing Toro. I ain't oversee these national archives all this time only to be ram jam, thank you, ma'am, quick and easy so, you understand? And I don't give a France if you as wealthy white man or famous books writer from America or whatever the ass it is, ain't nobody does touch this Xerox machine but me, you understand? And Miss Sam Lal Singh under my own supervision. And you could joke me and Miss Sam Lal Singh too till both with tooties smoking like bushfire, but wouldn't get you no closer to this machine. Understand? Good. Now you understand. So, Mr. Robert, I done checked through the card catalog, and fortunate for you, in the C.F. Stallmeyer Esquire collection is most of the numbers of that journal you're looking for, The Morning Star, dating from 5 Feb 1845 through the following year, approx. And I give them little look-see myself, and most is still in pretty good shape and not too smudge and tear, and you could read them good enough. And I check for them papers of this man you name, J.J. Etzler, and in the Stallmeyer collection you got them too, Paradise and all the rest, everything. And of course you got copies of all the local news from that era, POS Gazette and Standard, and even London Guardian microfiche self. Anyways, you got them all, Mr. Robot. And me and Miss Sam Lal Singh would be happy to hold them for you in the reserve front desk. But bear in mind, Mr. Robot, what I'm telling you, eh? Rules is rules, and laws is laws, and you cannot remove no documents from the place at all, at all. And just as the sign post upon the wall behind we own self-same front desk read out clear enough for you and all the world to see in the Queen's own proper English, and let me quote, under no circumstances are photocopies of archival documents permitted, and all laptops, scanners, cell phones, or other electronic devices are strictly forbidden on the premises. Only pencil and paper, Mr. Robert, to write down what you want and take enough notes for your research. Cordial, Miss Ramsoul, Director, TNT National Archives, P.S. Mr. Robert, you would find waiting for you at the reserve front desk photocopy of a story I find out the London Guardian microfiche trial of Mr. Etzler's satellite. I hope it please you. PSS. And if you want to see me again tonight, we could please meet at Pelican Round 9, same as usual. And I would be sure to wear my dental floss panties for you too. So that's Miss Ramsoul, and on the following page is the trial of Mr. Etzler's satellite, which I'm going to go to this. I'm going to go to this PowerPoint and show you some of how a lot of the. Okay, this is an email from Miss Ramsoul, and that's the language. So in a sense, Miss Ramsoul is kind of the fulfillment of Etzler's own obsession, because as she talks in numbers, and Etzler has said that only numbers speak the truth. And she provides these historical documents, and I have that little stamp at the top from the desk of Miss Ramsoul that, you know, kind of reminds the reader that these are coming from her. So this is the trial of Mr. Etzler's satellite. This is his land machine, and I can talk more about that later as we go along. And this is the article I just showed you was from the London Guardian. Here is an article from the Trinidad Guardian, and it's actually the trial in Trinidad of Etzler's naval automaton. That's his universal water machine. This is an advert that was taken out in the London Guardian, in which Etzler sold shares of the railway company that he planned to build in Trinidad. He was going to build it on wooden rails, which he tested himself and proved that how advantageous they were over steel rails in every way. This was the era of the great bubble railroad bubble companies, and this may have been the biggest of those. Etzler and Stallmeyer are the two engineers, and there the reader is invited to fill their name in. Probably the most important documents that Ms. Ramsall provides are various articles from the Morning Star. As if you'll remember, the Morning Star is the journal published in London that follows the progress of the TES, the Tropical Immigration Society. The pioneers would write back to England, and their letters would appear in the Star. And here is a letter from Stallmeyer and a letter from Etzler. Here is Etzler's very last letter to the TES before he disappeared with whatever money was remaining. And I told you how the culmination of my research was this, the discovery of this letter that was fished out of my ancestor's pocket on his deathbed. This is the letter that Ms. Ramsall provides, and this actually is one of the things that you'll see in the novel. Okay, one of the other ways that documents enter into the novel is that Willie, if you'll remember, he's telling the story to his teenage son. He has a cigar box full of documents next to him. So while he's talking, he will say, "Oh, I have a map to show you just what that is." And he'll fish through the documents and pick up the map and hand it to his son. But the most important document in that cigar box is a journal that his father kept of Chagua Barriga. And in that journal, Willie's father, made sketches of various things, took notes, etc. And so here is a sketch that from the notebook of Chagua Barriga Bay. Here is a sketch of how the hammocks were hung up in the compound. Also, here's a recipe for pepper pot that they cook in the Warahun Indians, who are kind of taking care of them, cook in the compound. When they attempt to offload the satellite from the barge that they've brought it to Chagua Barriga on, it falls into the water because it weighs two tons. And they actually have to figure out a way to get it out of the water and up onto the beach. And of course, by the time they do that, the whole thing is leaking rust all over the place. But this was the diagram of how they would get it up onto the beach. William climbs up into the mountains and looks down onto the compound. And this is an aerial photograph of the compound. And, you know, the gardens, the bay, etc. There's still the box there sitting in the water, the satellite box. So one of my favorite documents that come from that cigar box is this map that appears in the middle of the book. I like to put things in the very middle. It divides up the book structurally. And this is a historical novel, so I thought, well, a map is appropriate. This is a map of Port of Spain in 1845, but it's a very special kind of map. This is a personal map. It's a map that has been folded up and kept in someone's pocket. You can see on the back how the folds, it's been soiled. But my favorite part of this map is that Willie says, you know, I was telling somebody this story once, I can't even remember who it was, and I took a red pencil and I marked the exact path we walked through Port of Spain on the very first day of our arrival. They were going to meet the director of the colonial company who was going to take care of them. But there's the living red line. And I guess I should tell you that it was hell to try to get this into the book because, you know, full color becomes very expensive. This is a small independent publisher, Acacia, who I adore. And we just didn't think it could happen, but I was insistent that this map be there, that it be in full color, that it be a real map, you know, a two-sided map. And my publisher figured out that if they inserted it, it would cost nothing at all. I mean, 0.003 cents per copy. So that's how we managed to get it in there. But the main way that documents enter into the novel, or external documents enter into the novel, is through this companion website. The reader isn't even aware of this, presumably, as they're reading. At various points in the novel, the reader is directed to a link, and they will go to it and see various things, which I'll show you now. Eventually, the reader discovers that the home of all of these documents is this website, and there's lots more stuff that's not even referred to in the book itself. This is what the website. Oh, actually, yeah. Yeah, this is the homepage of the website. So one of the documents that's here, on the way over to Trinidad in the cross-Atlantic trip, Etzler actually writes a play that he performs with Mr. Stallmeyer for the other passengers. This is a common thing. They did this for entertainment. But Etzler's play is actually about his own enterprise. He performs it in blackface. He plays the part of an ex-slave who's talking about Etzler's project. And Stallmeyer plays the other character, who is a former estate owner. And the play actually takes place on top of the crate containing the satellite that's lashed down to the deck of the ship. The play is actually fashioned after one of Etzler's own documents. He wrote one in the form of a play. I don't know if he ever intended it to be performed, but I've basically used that as a model for my own purposes. The point is, though, that the reader doesn't get this play in the novel. The reader hears about it. The reader sees Etzler and Stallmeyer climb up onto the crate and start to perform. The reader sees the audience's reaction, etc. But they don't get the play itself. The play is here in the website, but what I've done is make it look exactly like one of Etzler's publications from 1846. This is the title of the play. And here you can see this is one of Etzler's own publications from 1846, and I've copied the same font, etc. And here is the play itself. So that's one of the documents. The other documents that I wanted the reader to have are Etzler's machines. I wanted the reader to be able to see Etzler's machines while he or she is reading about them. So this is the naval automaton, but it's actually a fake. What I've done is taken his mechanical drawings and manipulated it to suit the fiction. The truth is that my rendition of the naval automaton is much closer to the one that he actually built and tried. And this is more fake naval automaton. And here is a fake write-up of the patent of Etzler's machine that I've actually manipulated to suit my purposes. It looks exactly like Etzler's other patents from 1846. This is the satellite. Here is the real patent. I haven't touched it. I can explain to you more about these machines later if you're interested. I mean, the amazing thing about Etzler is that, you know, he talked about everything to the grandest possible scale. So the satellite would go round and round a fixed spindle, and therefore its name, right? But Etzler imagined this is called an orbit, and these are all individual. These are all individual orbits that make up a circuit, right? And then Etzler will talk about a dominion, which is, you know, so everything was carried, and of course surrounded by all of Etzler's numbers that basically just float off the page. You know, Etzler would say, okay, well, you know, we'll make a windmill to power our satellite. But then, before you know it, he's turned around and he's calculated the power of the wind over the surface of the globe. You know, he just always went to the farthest extreme. And this is the real patent of the satellite that... So the other document that I wanted the reader to have access to, David Henry Thoreau wrote a review of Etzler's Paradise, but his review is actually a kind of a synopsis of Etzler's whole project, his whole enterprise. And so the review is referred to in the novel. And the reader is given a link, and they can go to the actual review that Thoreau wrote. But I've given it to them in the very first publication, the 1845 publication. It appeared in the Democratic Review, but I've even made it look more real than the real thing. I mucked it up a little bit. You can't really see it here, but you see the print coming through from the back of the page, etc. And I've just taken the liberty of adding one footnote. Otherwise, I left it alone. I needed to get a little symbol in there. So my favorite document that's on this website is... the reader has heard about William's notebook. The reader has seen all of those sketches from his notebook. This is one of the documents that the reader has to discover on their own. Here, the reader gets the notebook itself. So here is the 1845 document with you know, William's drawing, that's his initial drawing of the bay. All of these notes that the reader hasn't seen, these are all the various crops that Mr. Carr grew in his gardens. This again is the way they strung up the hammocks. This is the recipe for pepper pot. This is the game in the surrounding forest, the fish, the mollusks. Here is that aerial view of Chagua Barriga. This is the way they got the satellite out of the water. Some notes for something else, I don't know what. At one point, the compound floods, and this is their plan of how to drain the flooded compound. Also, William becomes obsessed with, you know, there's no way for them to get out of this place, and William makes an attempt to refurbish an old schooner that's washed up on the beach. And the reader reads all about this, but comes here and finds that William actually drew a diagram of, you know, how he unearthed that schooner. I'm going backwards. And that's... Oh, this is the last thing that I will show you from the notebook. Remember I told you that I discovered this letter that my ancestor had written back to Powell in London that was fished out of his pocket on his deathbed. That's the only description we have of Chagua Barriga. Well, here you don't get the letter, but you get his notes for writing that letter. Those are all the things he wanted to tell Mr. Powell about. And here, what he did was he tore out pages of his notebook to write the letter. So there are the torn out pages. I'm going to just show you one more thing for fun. There are also two short films on this website. They don't really have anything to do with Etzler, so I don't think they have to do with the narrative. They are evocative. They're not informational. But in any case, one thing I wanted to have fun with was my acknowledgments. And I mean, these days I think acknowledgments at the end of books have gotten kind of ridiculous. People thank their house cleaners and the people who wash their clothes. And so I thought I would have some fun with this. There's a long preamble, but there's a cat that appears in the novel. It's in the bilge. Willie names the cat Mr. Talbot after the developer of the inventor of photography. He becomes the first photographer in Trinidad. I can talk more about that. But in any case, I made Mr. Talbot, the cat in the bilge in the novel, my own cat, thinking that somewhere along the line, I'm going to be able to put him in one of the films. Well, Mr. Talbot never made the films, but he made the acknowledgments. So... those are the acknowledgments. What's that? That's the person who washes my clothes. So that's my author website, and that's the novel's companion website, whatlessboys.com. Are there any questions? Yeah. It was sent to him. It was really popular. A lot of people were reading it, but it was sent to him for him to review. It may have been that it may have been the American magazine. Yeah, he had it for like 2 years before he got around to reviewing it. And he finally reviewed it, and the review is really kind of long and boring. But all he does is quote Etzler's text. So it kind of becomes this. What I didn't want to give the reader is Etzler's text. When I first started this project, they were really hard to find. Since then, they've been published together, and these are them. I mean, I think he had four or five texts that he published. I didn't want to give the reader those. I thought, well, the reader, they could get to them through the website, but I gave the reader the secondary stuff. And Thoreau, I mean, how am I not going to leave Thoreau alone? I mean, his own writing is kind of as amazing as Etzler's. Kind of. Yeah. Well. Yeah, I mean, he just makes no comment. He just dismisses him after that. He says, this guy's nuts. Yes. Yeah.
So do you get any indication that Etzler was able to kind of enter Trinidad so successfully because there was a kind of like financial panic and people were looking for Charlotte to kind of fill the gaps?
That was the big problem. I don't think they knew. The one thing is there was no land left to be had in Trinidad. He thought there was lots of available land. I'm not going to answer your question. Other than to say that I don't think they didn't know about Trinidad. All of the ideas that they had were totally screwed up. But to me, one of the most interesting things about Etzler's enterprise is that every immigration scheme in the West Indies began with labor, right? There were the slaves, then there were the indentured. First there were the Amerindians, then there were the African slaves, then there were the East Indian indentured laborers. Etzler went to the Caribbean, went to Trinidad and not the US because the slaves were emancipated. It's the opposite of every other labor scheme. And he went there with his machines that were not only going to perform all the labor, they were going to free everyone. This was the beginning of, humanity's great, moment, because with all of the labor taken care of, people could dedicate themselves to more important things, you know, like science and you know, being good to each other. That was Etzler's idea, that this would put an end, his machines would put an end to greed, you know. It was a kind of a religious project. Back there? Sina, did someone have a question at the back? No. Oh. Sure. Yeah, this is my mother's family, the Tuckers. They were among Etzler's first pioneers.
This is something that you knew about.
I didn't. That's what you missed. It's in the cabinet piece, but the way this all began was I read. There's a really kind of awful memoir, one of the first books published in Trinidad, and it contains a lot of pictures of old buildings and all the famous historical people in Trinidad. And I knew that it had one reference to a relative of mine. And the reference was, it's actually Willie Tucker, that 15-year-old boy. He had the first taxi in Trinidad. That taxi was a donkey cart that he drove between Port of Spain and Nerima, delivering packages and passengers. You know, I thought that was nice to know, but I'm hard to write a novel around that. So basically, I never really looked at the memoir too closely. But in the appendix, I came across three paragraphs on Etzler. And I thought, this is amazing. How could I have never heard of this guy? But the most interesting thing was the final sentence of those three paragraphs in the appendix. And the sentence was that despite the tragedy that ensued, several well-known families were established in Trinidad. And among the list of names was my mother's surname, Tucker. So I went to my mother and I said, what the hell is this? Who's the Tropical Immigration Society? Who is Etzler? She had no idea. I went to everybody I could think of in Trinidad, including a guy called Michael Anthony, who's the historian. I went to the last Stallmeyer relative. Nobody had heard of this guy. I have my own theories about that, but my mother did have a story that I can't repeat now because you missed it. But it's this horrific story about my first relative dying and him being brought back by his son. And I realized, well, that story makes sense if the Tuckers were, in fact, part of this enterprise, this society. So I got hold of all those, the extant numbers of the Morning Star. It was a stack of photocopies this high, and I started going through them looking for the name Tucker. And eventually, toward the end, I came across it again and again. And I found out that my relative was the one who was, you know, important to building and transporting the satellite. But finally, I came upon that letter, which is, you know, the only description of the compound. And when I had the letter, that was when I had the novel. So the reason why I think that this has been kind of blocked out of the the collective memory, is that this thing was so horrific. I think 37 members went over and something like 14 died in the space of a couple weeks. And Stallmeyer and Etzler never even went to the compound. They sent all these pioneers out there. And they started blaming the pioneers, saying, oh, it's their own fault. They're selfish and stuff like that. So the people in Trinidad were just aghast, to say the least. But my sense of things is that it was just so horrific that it was, repressed. I don't know. That's why it was kind of so fascinating to find all this stuff. Yeah. That was. Yeah. Yeah, the wealthiest. Yeah. I mean, if you look at that inquest, they quote Stallmeyer and they say, he's like unbelievable. He's an unbelievable asshole, the stuff that he says about these people who have given their lives for his enterprise. He calls them selfish and so forth. How Stallmeyer stayed is kind of beyond me. He and Etzler were starting this railroad, and a lot of people, it turned out to be a big farce, and they had a lot of people's money and stuff. I mean, kind of an amazing, amazing story. So, yeah, thank you very much. So, I made my not quite famous rum punch for all of you. Please help yourself. There are famous doubles from Ali's at the back, so help yourself to those as well. At Trinidad Street Food, and copies of the book. And thanks again to Sina for having me tonight and all of us, and also for publishing me in this amazing, amazing magazine. Thanks a lot.